From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. In the 1960s, Ken Kesey was one of America's most popular novelists and most celebrated hippies. On today's Fresh Air, the author of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest discusses his latest project, a collaborative novel written with the students of his University of Oregon writing class. Also today, we talk about concerned photographers with former photojournalist Cornell Kappa. Several years after his brother Robert, the esteemed war photographer, was killed on assignment, Cornell decided to devote his life to exhibiting and preserving the work of photojournalists. World music critic Milo Miles examines the lives and music of two salsa singers, and Leslie Savin looks at how Zen can sell cars. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. Colombian authorities said today one of the country's leading drug lords was shot to death along with his son and 15 bodyguards. Gonzalo Rodriguez Gacha was considered the third highest-ranking member of Colombia's Medellin cocaine cartel. Rodriguez Gacha was a member of the Extraditables, a drug-backed group which declared total war on the Colombian establishment last August after the government began its latest crackdown on the drug trade. In Panama, the 510-member People's Assembly, controlled by General Manuel Noriega, today declared Panama is in a state of war with the United States. The declaration came as the Assembly named Noriega Maximum Leader for National Liberation. Details from David Adams.
General Noriega appeared relaxed and confident as he accepted the nomination from the Assembly to be civilian head of government as well as military chief. In uncharacteristic fashion, he read from a prepared text. Many of the 510 assembly members, wearing peasant straw hats, stood up to cheer at intervals, although there appeared to be an absence of enthusiasm. When one old man stood up to say gringos and gringo lovers should be killed, the audience applauded and laughed nervously. Comments like that are hardly going to frighten Washington, but the White House will be alarmed by General Noriega's ability to do as he pleases. General Noriega's appointment changes little in effect. As commander-in-chief of the armed forces, he already exercises total control in Panama. The National Assembly isn't an elected body. Its members are chosen for loyalty to the general. Panama's constitutional National Assembly was dissolved in September. For National Public Radio, this is David Adams in Panama City.
The Bush administration says it's unconcerned with Noriega's new status. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
In naming Noriega maximum leader, the People's Assembly formally gave him greater powers than Provisional President Francisco Rodriguez, a situation that already existed de facto. Deputy Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger called the action a charade and nonsense. He said that as far as the Bush administration is concerned, there is no government in Panama anyway. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said the naming of Noriega as maximum leader was another hollow step in an attempt to force his rule on the Panamanian people. Fitzwater said there has been no change in the alert status of U.S. troops in Panama, nor has there been any direct contact with the Panamanian government. This is Brian Naylor at the White House.
Bulgaria's communist leadership announced today an end to the party's monopoly on power within a month and agreed to begin roundtable talks with the opposition next week. The declaration was aimed at heading off a repetition of protests from the previous evening when some 40,000 jeering Bulgarians outside the parliament demanded an immediate repeal of the constitutional clause that guarantees the party's leading role. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 14 points to close at 2739.55. Declines led advances 3-2. This is NPR News. The High Court in South Africa today threw out convictions imposed in the country's longest treason trial and freed five black activists, including three prominent anti-apartheid leaders, jailed since 1985. Scores of jubilant supporters, including Anglican Archbishop Desmond Tutu and the Reverend Alan Bosek, welcomed the men as they passed through Cape Town's airport en route to their homes near Johannesburg. Bosek was arrested in the pandemonium surrounding their arrival. The 51 Vietnamese boat people deported from Hong Kong earlier this week have now returned to their homes in and around the port city of Haiphong. As the BBC's Jack Thompson reports, both the Vietnamese and British officials refused to give journalists access to the deportees.
All journalists have seen is a video recording of the arrival of the 51 boat people at Hanoi Airport on Tuesday. It was made by a British embassy official and shows nothing more than the unloading of the deportees' luggage and their anxious glances as they left the TriStar airliner charged. started to fly them to Hanoi. The first to step back onto Vietnamese territory was a small, wide-eyed boy of about 10, quickly followed by groups of men, women, and children offering no resistance to the Hong Kong immigration officials who'd escorted them on the flight. The deportees then identified their bags before boarding buses, which took them to a transit camp about 20 miles from Hanoi. Among the deportees were two pregnant women, carefully escorted from the plane, but left to their own devices once they were on the airport tarmac.
The BBC's Jack Thompson in Hanoi. The U.S. Army said today that an Army board has refused to grant the Medal of Honor to a World War II veteran who colleagues claim was passed over for a decoration because he was Jewish. David Rubitsky had been recommended for the medal by company and battalion commanders. They cited a battle in the jungles of New Guinea in which Rubitsky was said to have killed more than 500 Japanese soldiers. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We'd planned to bring you an interview with jazz musician and arranger Jerry Mulligan, but that's been rescheduled for the next Fresh Air. My guest today is Ken Kesey. Kesey wrote two of the more popular novels of the 1960s. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is set in a mental institution where the patients finally rebel against the sterile, repressive hospital regimen. Sometimes a Great Notion is set in Oregon logging country. But in some circles, Kesey became even better known as being one of the first people to bring the experimental hallucinogenic LSD out of the research laboratory and into the culture. Kesey and his friends, known as the Merry Pranksters, were among the first and most celebrated of the West Coast hippies. In the book The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, Tom Wolfe described the Pranksters' escapades driving around the country in their Dayglo school bus. The driver was usually Neil Cassady, who was immortalized as the character Dean Moriarty in Jack Kerouac's novel On the Road. Ken Kesey hasn't published much since the 60s and has remained pretty much out of the public eye. He lives on a farm in Oregon. His short pieces from the past two decades were collected in the 1986 book Demon Box. His latest project is the book Caverns. It's a collaborative novel written by the students in his writing class at the University of Oregon. The authorship is credited to O.U. Levin, which is an anagram for the University of Oregon novel. The book includes an introduction by Kesey. I asked Ken Kesey why he had his class write a collective novel.
It's an idea I've had for a long time, for a number of reasons. I feel that a lot of writing classes end up being in competition with each other, and that's the best they get out of it, that is kind of intellectual, literary infighting. And we came out of a very exceptional class in the 60s that all of us who were part of the class are kind of in awe of now that it's passed. And I wanted to create this same sense of all of us being part of a team working for the same goal at the end of the project, and so that we weren't in competition with each other in any form.
Did you do writing yourself?
We all did, yeah. Mm-hmm. When we first met, I told him there's only two rules that I have for this class. One is that we can't tell anybody the plot of the novel until it's done. Your wife, no reporters, nobody, no English professors. And the other one was that I make up half the class, so that if it came down to a real argument about where the novel was going, that all they could do was tie me up. They couldn't... All I had to do is browbeat one of them, and it would go my direction. I told them, this is not democracy, this is art, and we've got to keep going forward with it, because otherwise we'll get in there, we'll be talking about the difference between Henry James and Hemingway.
How much writing have you been doing over the past few years?
Oh, quite a lot. I write all the time. Mm-hmm. I just don't publish that much. For one thing, I've got a lot of other stuff that I'm doing, like just coming from doing this rehearsal over at Lincoln Center with the Trick of the Squirrel piece. I've done that a number of times and traveled around the country doing it. I've got a large farm. I was going pretty good on a book in 1984 and had a kid die, and it really took the wind out of my sails, and I felt like working with this class at the University of Oregon got me moving again. I'm turning out quite a bit of manuscript now that I haven't for a long time.
Mm-hmm. You know, you say something in the introduction to caverns that I wanted to ask you about. You write that you'd studied with Wallace Degner at Stanford. And you write that in your university days, he mistook you for an anti-intellectual, but what you really were was a near illiterate. Elaborate on that.
Well, as I told you, I majored in radio and television. I knew Fibber McGee and Molly and Jack Benny, but I wasn't too well versed in Faulkner and William Blake. Those were new things to me. When I got down to Stanford, I realized that I was not nearly as well read as most of the other people in the class.
Were you uncomfortable about that? Did you feel like you had all this catching up to do?
I felt like a country fool walked in with stuff between my toes, yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're living on your farm now.
Same old farm, yeah.
You know, it's funny, in your prankster days, you were seen as being part of a group that had made such a break with the past. And yet here you are living on a family farm. It had been owned by someone else in your family before you. You're, I believe, still married to the woman who you've been married to since, what is it, 1956?
Long time, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, there's been this incredible continuity in your life between past and present in a lot of ways.
Well, old Tommy Wolfe has a lot to do with that misconception. When New York wants to view somebody's personality, they want it in terms of a sound bite. They don't want to have it get too complex. It's like coming over here tonight. We got out there in the traffic, and we come in here late, and I just hate to come into a place late because I know that's what they expect of me, you know, because of my prankster upbringing. I know that, yeah, here he is, he's late, just he probably messed up. But I'm not. I've always been a fairly reliable, straight-up-the-middle-of-the-road citizen that just happens to be an acid head.
You say that you blame Tommy Wolfe for these misconceptions about you're referring to Tom Wolfe's book, The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test. Did you like the book?
Oh, yeah, it's a good book. Yeah.
And do you feel... Yeah, go ahead.
Wolf's a genius. He did a lot of that stuff. He's only around 3 weeks. He picked up that amount of dialogue and verisimilitude without tape recorder, without taking notes to any extent. He just watches very carefully and remembers. But, you know, he's got his own editorial filter there, and so what he's coming up with is part of me, but it's not all of me, you know, any more than Hunter S. Thompson is loaded all the time and shooting machine guns at John Denver. That's the sort of thing interesting in the media, but he's got a lot more life to him than that.
Ken Kesey is my guest, and he has a new book that's actually a collaborative book that was written by his students, and the book is called Caverns. What effect did the electric Kool-Aid acid test have on you? For instance, did it make the police feel more determined to try to bust you again?
Yeah, but I haven't been worried about the cops that much. The effect Kool-Aid acid test has is it's as though, say, that you're Richard Gere and you got a great big wart on the side of your nose, and they begin to play it up in the cameras, and then pretty soon it becomes a thing that a lot of teenage girls are in love with, and then pretty soon you're looking at it too until you're cross-eyed looking at your own wart.
Why do you use the wart as an analogy?
Well, because I was a lot more than the Tom Wolfe depiction, and mm-hmm. I think this is a problem for a lot of American writers and has been for a long time. You know, Hemingway, he doesn't really get into trouble until he becomes dazzled by his own image. He sees the rest of the United States looking at him, and he moves over and sits there, and he looks at himself, too. And then when he tries to go back and get inside of his own skin, he can't quite fit into it as well as he used to. He's gained weight. He can't put his own skin back on. When you're writing, it's not a good idea to be observed too much, unless you want to live in New York and wear white clothes. if you really are interested in being a real straight, old-fashioned writer, it's better to live down in Mississippi like Faulkner and work out in the woodshed and not be seen but once every 10 years. I think that being the observed always turns your eye back on yourself, and you become kind of blinded by your own radiance.
You started doing LSD through a government experiment, an experimental program, and I think it was 1959. And you were one of the volunteers who volunteered to take this experimental drug and have it tested on yourself. How did you become a volunteer for these experiments?
One of the guys that was our neighbors was a psychologist, and he was supposed to show up one day and just really didn't have the common hair to do it, and says, "Would anybody else like to take my place?" And I, at the time, was training for the Olympics. I made it to be an alternate in the 1960 Olympics team and was in
good
shape.
As a wrestler?
Yeah, as a wrestler. I'd never been drunk on beer, you know, let alone done any drugs, but this is the American government. They said, "Come in here. We've just discovered this new spot of space, and we want somebody to go up there and look it over, and we don't want to do it. We want to hire you students." And I was one of 140 or so that it eventually turned out it was CIA-sponsored. I didn't believe it for a long time. Well, Allen Ginsberg says, "You know who was paying for that? It was the CIA." I said, "Oh, no, Allen, you're just paranoid." But he finally got all the darn records, and it did turn out the CIA was doing this, and it wasn't being done to try to cure insane people, which is what we thought. It was being done to try to make people insane, to weaken people and to be able to put them under the control of interrogators. This didn't, we didn't find this out for 20 years. And by that time, the government had said, "Okay, stop that experiment. All these guinea pigs that we've sent up there into outer space, bring them back down, and don't ever let them go back up there again, because we don't like the look in their eyes."
Do you remember what your very first trip was like when you were a volunteer in this government program? And what kind of preparation were you given for it? Were you given any?
None at all. Except I'd read a little piece in Life magazine about how they'd given it to cats, and cats were afraid of mice once they'd had LSD. But I think that we'd been preparing for a long time. You know, I knew the Bible. I knew the Bhagavad Gita. I knew the Tao Te Ching. I had read Hermann Hesse's Journey to the East, which gave us an underpinning spiritually so that these phenomena that were happening to us had something that we could relate to. I think a lot of people who are just jumping into drugs now, they don't have anything to relate it to, and I think people have been, for one thing, people have been doing psychedelics for thousands and thousands of years, trying to find out what's on the real books, and we just happened to come at a time when it was not only a lot of stuff happening chemically, there was a lot of new changes in music and in film. Burroughs was just beginning to do his work in literature. There was a movement afoot that this was just a part of, and mm-hmm. It was exciting. It was wonderful.
What was that very first trip like, though, under the experimental conditions?
Groovy, man. It was groovy. We suddenly realized that there's a lot more to this world than we previously thought. I think, because I'm asked this question a lot, it's been 20 years or so, and people are always coming back saying, "Well, what do you think?" And one of the things that I think came out of it is that there's room. We don't all have to be the same. We don't have to have Baptists coast to coast. We can throw in some Buddhists and some Christians and people who are just thinking totally strange thoughts about the Irish leprechauns, that there is room spiritually for everybody in this universe.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is Ken Kesey. His novels, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Sometimes a Great Notion, were among the most popular novels of the 1960s. Kesey's exploits with the group known as the Merry Pranksters were chronicled in Tom Wolfe's book, The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test. And Kesey now teaches writing at the University of Oregon, and his class has just published a collaborative novel called Caverns. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Ken Kesey is my guest. You were among the first people to take LSD out of the clinical setting and use it in a social setting. How did you first get it out?
Of the hospital?
Yeah.
Ooh. Well, after I'd gone through these drug experiments and was in this little room in the hospital, looking out through the little window at the people out there who were the regular nuts. They weren't students going through experiments. Looking at them through my crazed eyes, I saw that these people have something going, and there's a truth to it that people are missing, and that's how I came to write Cuckoo's Nest. I got a job at the Nut House and worked from midnight to 8, writing that book and taking care of these patients on this one ward, and made a lot of good friends, some that I still have. And I found that my key opened a lot of the doors to the doctor's offices where these drugs were being kept. That's how.
Huh. And then you had friends who were able to make it in their own laboratories.
Yeah, but they never was anywhere as good as that good government stuff. That's the government. The CIA always has the best stuff.
You know, you brought up Cuckoo's Nest, and I was wondering, when you were working in the psychiatric ward, which is what Cuckoo's Nest is based on, and I think you sometimes went in there high on hallucinogenics. Do you think you ended up writing Cuckoo's Nest in a way, projecting your experiences as a quote, sane person high on drugs, projecting those experiences onto people who maybe had, like, serious problems?
Well, these people that had serious problems, I mean, I saw people hallucinating and people in bad shape.
Mm-hmm.
Make no mistake about it. Being crazy is painful, and being crazy is hell, whether you get it from taking a drug or whether it happens because you're just trying to lead the American way of life and it keeps kicking your legs out from under you. One way or another, it's hell on you, and it's nothing that's fun about it, and I am certainly not recommending it. It is a lens through which I looked at stuff, but it's hard on the eyes. But I think I had a very valid viewpoint, and much closer than a lot of the doctors were having. At that time, you know, everything was Freudian. If you were messed up, it was because of something that had happened to you when you were in the bathroom as a kid. And with these experiences, not, and I don't just mean drug experiences, there were a lot of other things that were going on that were emphasizing this. John Coltrane's music was saying the same thing. It was saying something is wrong and it's making us a little crazy, and that is making us crazy enough to hallucinate, whether we were promoting it ourselves or it was being imposed on us. I don't want to argue that now, but when I felt so good after being on there all night to know that I was wearing a green uniform. And I mean, a white uniform instead of a green uniform, so I could leave in the morning and go home. Otherwise, there wasn't that much difference between me and those people they were locking up.
Mm-hmm.
It gave me an empathy that I could never have come up with. A better example is those first three pages of Cuckoo's Nest were written on peyote. And I don't know any Indians. I don't know where that Indian came from. I've always felt humbled by that character. Without the character of that Indian, the book is a melodrama. You know, it's a straight battle between McMurphy and the big nurse. But that Indian's consciousness, to filter that through, that makes it exceptional.
Did you find that hallucinogenics would bring out things in your writing, or did you find also that sometimes it would be hard to write when you were high?
Oh, you see a lot of really groovy stuff on hallucinogenics and write it down and 24 hours look at it and realize, you know, I can't even read this. So there were a lot of mistakes made by everybody who thought they were doing wonderful creative works high on drugs, and then later on found that what they were doing was finger painting.
Have you given up drugs, or I don't know, maybe I shouldn't be asking this, but
we're into it now. Go ahead.
Do you still do them at all? Or?
On religious occasions, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I like to walk up on a mountain on Easter and get a sense of rebirth. Some people jog, some people meditate, you know, there's certain people whip themselves on the back. Everybody has their own way of trying to see past the veil, and this is just the one that I happen to come up with.
At what point did you decide to give up the kind of prankster's life? The story that I've heard is the pranksters went to Woodstock, you didn't want to go, and when they came back to a sign hung in your driveway that just said, no.
Well, there were 61 people when they headed out to Woodstock, and after they were gone, I went upstairs, and we live in a barn. We still live in the same barn, and we've fixed it up, and it's a pretty nice place. But at that time, there was still hay in the loft of the barn, and I found one of these little hippie warrens where they dug in with their ratty old sleeping bags and their copy of Zap magazine, and stuck right down in the hay bale was a candle, which had burned right down to the hay before it had gone off. And I thought, hey, enlightenment's one thing, but being this loose is, I mean, my grandpa wouldn't allowed them up there, my great-grandpa wouldn't have, and there's certain things that take precedent over enlightenment.
And so, that's when you send everybody home, basically.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, did you foresee in the 60s the drug problems of the 80s?
No, not at all. Actually, I did in some way. I had a... I spoke to a bunch of citizens at the University of Oregon in probably 1969, and I told them that this was coming, that the best thing to do about it would be to separate marijuana from all the other drugs by legalizing marijuana. I said that a long, long time ago, and I still believe it, that all of these other drugs which are connected to marijuana. And I really don't know much about those. That's why I don't get into them. I've never seen any of the stuff they're talking about, the crack and ice and stuff. So I kind of keep my talking about drugs, about the stuff I know. And I really don't fool with it very much. My metaphor is this, is that you don't need a huge tuning fork. We used to think we used to have a tuning fork 8 foot long and weighed 2,000 pounds just to find middle C. But now... all you need is a little bitty tuning fork once a year, maybe. But no, I don't know anybody who really goes out and gets ripped anymore. And I do feel some responsibility for what's come about. Although I've never tried to sell drugs, there's not enough to go around. I've always tried to sell truth. Just let people tell the truth about it, and pretty soon I think people will work it out, just like with cigarettes. Gradually, by telling the truth about cigarettes, less and less men are smoking. A lot of women are still smoking, but less and less men are smoking.
Ken Kesey, thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, take it easy.
Ken Kesey's latest project, Caverns, is a collaborative novel written by his writing class at the University of Oregon. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, our rescheduled interview with baritone saxophonist, arranger, and composer Jerry Mulligan. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Kappa family has done much to advance the art of photojournalism. Robert Kappa was a celebrated war photographer who died in Indochina on assignment. His brother Cornell is a former photographer for Life magazine and the founder of the International Center of Photography. Coming up, Cornell Kappa talks about the changing role of photojournalism. Also, world music critic Milo Miles reviews the work of two queens of salsa, Celia Cruz and La Lupe. And automakers used to use sex to sell cars. Now they use fancy photography and even a touch of Zen. Leslie Savin examines this advertising trend. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In a shootout in Colombia, police today killed Gonzalo Rodriguez Gacha, one of the most powerful drug barons in the country. Killed along with the drug figure were his 17-year-old son and 15 other people. The drug trafficker was considered to be the number two man in the Medellin cartel and on the list of the most wanted by the U.S. Justice Department. The State Department has issued a warning of possible terrorist attacks in Western Europe or North Africa over the holidays. The warning comes less than a week before the anniversary of the explosion that destroyed Pan Am Flight 103 over Scotland last year. NPR's Neil Conan has more.
Spokesman Nancy Beck says there is no specific threat against Americans or against airlines, but it does say that attacks could be planned against U.S. interests. The warning says there have been recent reports of movement by Middle Eastern terrorists in Western Europe, combined with the discovery of weapons and plastic explosives in Spain last month. Beck said there was sufficient reason to be concerned and to pass that concern to the American people. Following the bombing of Pan Am 103, the State Department was criticized for failing to publicize warnings, and Beck said that today's public warning went out at the same time as notifications to U.S. diplomatic and military personnel. No travel plans have been changed, she said. A similar warning was issued last summer. Travelers are not being advised to change their plans, Beck said, but to take this warning into account when they make their decisions about travel. This is Neil Conan reporting.
A Boeing 747 jumbo jet carrying 245 passengers and crew was forced to make an emergency landing in Anchorage, Alaska today, shortly after passing through a cloud of volcanic ash from the erupting Redoubt volcano. Bruce Meltzer of member station KSKA in Anchorage reports.
The KLM flight bound from Anchorage to Tokyo lost power in all four engines today, shortly after it flew through a cloud of fine volcanic ash from the Redoubt volcano. Federal Aviation Administration spokeswoman Mary Lou Witalik says the plane dropped 13,000 feet before the crews restarted the engines and flew safely back to Anchorage. Witalik says the volcanic ash was so fine it was not detected on the jet's radar, and the pilot was not aware of the ash until it appeared on his windshield. The FAA had imposed flight restrictions because of the ash, but Witalik says the KLM plane was not flying in a restricted area. There were no injuries reported among the passengers and crew. Mount Redoubt has been erupting on and off since yesterday morning. For National Public Radio, I'm Bruce Melzer in Anchorage, Alaska.
A federal jury in Seattle has found the late Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos and his widow liable for the 1981 murders of two anti-Marcos activists. The jury awarded the families of the victims $14 million. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down over 14 points to close at 2,739. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Musicians who flee political upheavals in their countries are unwilling expatriates. With a solid immigrant community to support them and a bit of luck, they may become stars in their adopted country. But with just a couple of wrong turns, expatriates can fall very hard. World music commentator Milo Miles explores the divergent fates of two queens of the music known in this country as salsa.
It may be that people are simply fascinated with contrasting pairs, but it seems that every style of music offers at least two great stars who are very alike but strikingly different. Often, one is very smooth, the other rough. One is very instinctive, the other more polished. If you don't mind a couple of dry academic words, one is Apollonian, the other Dionysian. In the Afro-Cuban music called salsa, a superb contrasting pair of women singers is Celia Cruz and La Lupe. Who on earth is La Lupe, you ask? Well, therein lies her tale. Nowadays, she is as obscure as Celia Cruz is famous. But let us begin with Cruz, the classic, the polished. If you know anything about modern Spanish language dance music, you know her. And to say she is the more controlled of our couple is not to suggest she lacks ardent fire.
Pa mí, tú no eres nada. Tú tienes la bemba colorada. Pa mí, tú no eres nada. Tú tienes la bemba colorada. Canta tu rumba, canta tu son, tu guarachita y tu danzón. Ay, pa mí, tú no eres nada. Tú tienes la bemba colorada.
Somehow the thrilling pace and bursting vitality of Celia Cruz in concert has never been quite captured on a record. Cruz can still sweep an audience of thousands in her wake. She tells fables of heartbreak, cracks jokes, radiates erotic waves. She drops you into a whirlwind of varied lives, filled with the common touch she knows from growing up in poverty in pre-revolutionary Cuba. But Cruz was ill at ease with Castro's new order, and in 1959 she moved first to Mexico and then New York. She's become the unquestioned queen of salsa in this country, but has never forgotten her home.
Cuba, estás muy triste. Tú que siempre fuiste como cascabeles de felicidad. Pero recuerda en tu historia que el son al mundo le di. Y en sus notas siempre lleva la alegría que perdiste y que pronto volverá. Ven y baila el son cubano, que es alegre y antillano. Ven y borra de la tierra en que nació.
A recent collection of Cruz's music with particularly sharp sound and adroit programming is called Introducing Celia Cruz on the British Cayente label. The CD includes hits from the 70s and some remakes of earlier numbers. Celia Cruz may be ubiquitous, but a corresponding collection on Cayente is about the only place you can find La Lupe anymore. But she comes right out at you and lets you know she's there.
Le pica suave negro en el tambor. Que suito dar un golpe en el timbal. Y la reina va a cantar. La yiyiyi va a soñar. Que se ha formado ya el gran rumbón. ¡Ya! Chuito, mira, suena los cueros.
The La Lupe collection is called Too Much, and that's very apt. Ernest Hemingway said Lupe was the creator of the art of frenzy, and he wasn't kidding. During performances, she would rip her clothes, bite her own arms, pound on musicians, and generally carry on like one possessed. As might be expected, the Too Much anthology is a bit uneven. It includes one of the many, many terrible versions of the Beatles' Yesterday, but other tracks show La Lupe could get across in English.
Never know how much I love you. Never know how much I care. And when you put your arms around me, I get the fever that's so hard to bear. You give me fever. Ay! When you kiss me, fever. When you hold me tight, fever. In the morning, fever all through the night.
La Lupe was too much for many folks. Too much for Cuba. Too much for Mexico. And finally, too much for the Fania Record Company, despite her years of success singing with bandleader Tito Puente. Like a lot of wild things, La Lupe faded away after the 60s, and her current whereabouts are unknown. Is she as superlative a singer as Celia Cruz? No. Her variety of tone and range of expression is decidedly more limited, but La Lupe hardly deserves to be forgotten. Too Much is a timely reminder that the rough gals deserve some of the same applause given to the polished queens.
Myla Miles is a freelance journalist who writes regularly about pop music for The Village Voice.
Tengo una pena en el alma. Tengo una pena de amor. Desde que no puedo verte, mucho he llorado porque yo tengo una pena en el alma. Tengo una pena de amor. Cuando más pude quererte, sin detenerte, te dije adiós.
This is Fresh Air. In 1974, photojournalist Cornell Kappa gave up taking pictures to devote himself to showing and preserving the work of what he describes as concerned photographers. He founded the International Center of Photography in New York, which has become the nation's premier gallery for photojournalism. Kappa's brother, the esteemed war photographer Robert Kappa, was killed on assignment in Indochina in 1954. Cornell Kappa is a former Life magazine photographer and a former president of the photographers' collective Magnum, which Robert co-founded in 1947. An exhibition of the work of Magnum photographers is touring the country and is currently on view at the two galleries of the ICP. A companion photography book called In Our Time has just been published by Norton. I asked Cornell Kappa to elaborate on his expression, concerned photographers.
Well, this has been bugging me for about 155 years. Photographers who just take images of be it beauty or being decorative, et cetera, is one kind of a thing. But when you try to educate people, you're trying to change social conditions, to confront people with what life is all about and try to change their mind or try to influence them, is what a concerned photographer would do.
Tell me why you stopped taking photographs yourself.
Well, the major point, of course, is that I couldn't find a place for photography of some urgency to be shown in New York City, for one, okay? Nobody really collected photographs. Nobody really collected negatives. Nobody had preservation notions because there was no place and no money for any of that. And I felt that there had to be a place for collecting, for preserving, for presenting photographs so that we can have a bank of our past history and all the rest of it. So in order to have that happen, I started an institution that would be dedicated to what we're talking about.
And that left no time to do your own photographs?
Oh, my God. I mean, seven days and seven nights it took to create an institution, what we did in the last 15 years. It was a fantastically pressing, difficult, overwhelming occupation.
Let me ask you a few questions about the days when you were taking photographs. Now, your brother Robert Kappa was a famous war photographer.
Right.
Now, you never went in that direction yourself. I was wondering if that had to do with the fact that your brother was already doing that, or if your sensibility and your temperament was one that made war photography the wrong occupation for you.
Well, first of all, we are separated in time. He was involved in photography from 1931. To 1954, when he died in Indochina. He stepped on an anti-personal mine and he died there. And my photography really began in 1947 when I joined Life Staff. He lived in a wartime world. I lived in a peacetime world. His concerns for humanity were the same as mine, but he did it at a different time period under different pressures. So Number one, I did not have the notion at all to be... One war photographer in the family was more than plenty. So I had no ambition at all to be a second war photographer. And our times were different, and my sensibility of social concern was for about old age, retarded children, etc., etc. I had a different direction in photography.
Mm-hmm. Did you used to worry about his safety when he was a war photographer?
Well, not really. My mother was the one who was tremendously concerned about his safety, as mothers do that. Since I was also in the army and all that, my feelings about war and my fears and all the rest of it were quite different. And of course, one more thing which was very strong with us. Bob had great amount of courage and luck and capacity to survive. And as a very experienced adventurer, one gave him the benefit of safety. It's obvious he's going to survive. So the interesting thing what you're getting at, of course, beyond that, he was a gambler with whatever he did all the time. My father was a gambler, but my father gambled differently from Bob about their own betting on something, on themselves, kind of a way. Bob estimated his chances, gauged his chances of how to deal with the situation when he was endangered. And he did extremely well. He didn't, practically had no scratch on him from 1931 to 1954 until his death. The one thing that bothered him, one thing that he feared, is a mine which was buried. You could not see it. You couldn't estimate what it would mean to you. And as it turned out, that's one that got him eventually.
Mm-hmm. How did you first start taking pictures?
Oh, I was a very lucky fellow. Born in Budapest, Hungary. My brother was one of the young students who rebelled against Admiral Horthy, the regime of Admiral Horthy. And he was one of those students that you see on the streets of Prague today.
Mm-hmm.
And he had to leave Hungary under some very urgent reasons for giving him a chance to get out before they put him to jail. So he went to Berlin in 1931, and then Hitler came to Berlin, so he had to leave again, and he ended up in Paris. And in Paris, now we get into the rest of the story, of course, the 35-millimeter camera Leica was invented in 1931 in Germany, and it gave a whole new impetus to see the world through a small camera which you could use it as your memory, as your eyes, and it you could move with it. You did not become a press photographer with a big camera, with a tripod, with a magnesium light. And he had a Leica. He met his friend Henri Cartier-Bresson, a Frenchman. He met his friend Shim, a Polish exile in Paris. And the three of them started to look at the world through the camera, and they contributed to magazines. And magazines printed their stories, their picture stories. And eventually they went to Spain and did some other things, which became the war coverage, war correspondence. Life magazine was born, Picture Post in England was born, and Match magazine in Paris was born. The whole age of photojournalism came upon us. The mass circulation picture magazine was born. So when I went to Paris to join my brother, I met these two other fellows, and three of them and me, we got involved with photography. I got involved through them.
Mm-hmm.
Then eventually, let me make the next jump. World War II occurred, started out, and the three guys, Cartier-Bresson, Frenchman, Shim, Paul, my brother, Bob, they all met in 1947 in Paris again, and they became unemployed war photographers, so they decided to do a cooperative they wanted to cooperate themselves, and they created an agency of photojournalists, who they were, unemployed, who they were, and Magnum was born.
Well, you were the president of Magnum from 1956 to 59. What kind of independence do you think that this photography collective gave to photographers that they didn't have before?
Well, before Magnum was born, there was no cooperative of photographers who owned their own fate, their own destiny. It was a whole new idea. It's not the Associated Press. It is not a Black Star. It is not an agency owned and run by an owner. These group of people joined as collaborators, as an international cooperative. And it was a whole new idea. They would own their own pictures. They have their own copyright. They would be controlling their own product. They would make their own prints. They would create their own captions. And they would try to enforce their own position, their own point of view, in their photographs and in the captions that accompanied them. They would feed the world press with their own work. The whole revolutionary new idea. And, of course, that has been going on for 40 years now, with ups and downs, success and failure. Their own success, their own failure, and they have affected the rest of the world, because now there are many, many more press agencies who are doing a similar affiliations like Magnum is.
Cornell Kappa is the founder and director of the International Center of Photography in New York, which is currently showing the work of Magnum photographers. The work of Magnum photographers is also collected in the new book, In Our Time. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. Today we revisit Stockton, California, where this January, you may recall, one gunman killed 5 children, wounded 30 other people. It's a continuation of our series on guns in America. We'll also have a report about Panama's declaration of war against the United States. From China, we'll hear about what American sanctions have meant to the Chinese economy and to Chinese leaders, a profile of the leader of the East German communists. And have you noticed in the New York Times, perhaps maybe I'm the only one who's noticed, more and more often they're telling us how to pronounce names?
Yeah.
Well, we'll have radio's answer to a pronunciation guide.
Okay, thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Two new Japanese-made cars are selling very well on the American market, Infiniti and Lexus. They've also gotten a lot of attention because of their ads. Commentator Leslie Savin analyzes their messages.
You have a natural unconscious rhythm when you drive, a flow of intentional and unintentional movement as you settle in behind the wheel and accelerate to cruising speed, as you tune the radio and grip the steering wheel. A true luxury car can anticipate those movements, accommodate them, respond easily and predictably to them. That's the nature of Infiniti.
There have been an amazing number of Infiniti ads, 29 since August. The idea has been to whop us with tranquility. Instead of showing the car, the ads focus on a simple nature scene, a flock of geese or raindrops hitting a pond. During a night of TV yakety-yak, the spots are a sensual break. And because the product that inspires this unconventional format is rarely seen, we're supposed to imbue it with a certain majesty. But then the narrator goes and ruins it. With the forced calm of a cult member, he keeps jabbering in ad after ad about philosophy. He finds Zen-like clarity in $40,000 sedans. He just won't shut up. Like Toyota's new Lexus car, Infiniti is supposed to be a new category of automobile. functional luxury. The Lexus ads are more traditional. Shots of cars hugging mountain roads while a voiceover pumps the message.
6 years ago, a new carmaker called Lexus began a relentless pursuit of luxury, of performance, and of safety. Introducing the Lexus LS400 luxury sedan. Lexus, the result of a relentless pursuit of perfection.
Lexus is appealing to desire and snobbery. Infiniti appeals to humility and snobbery. It's targeting neo-traditionalists, people whose household income may be $100,000, but who are, as an Infiniti man explains, more concerned with intrinsic kinds of values. That's fortunate, because the Infiniti cars don't look very special, nothing like the high-gloss glamour of a Mercedes. Better for them to sell inner luxury to inner-directed people. There's one surefire way to pry these new traditionalists from their wads: art. Art-wise, the ads are Hiroshige meets Michael Stedman. The new traditionalists, as opposed to the nouveau riche, know that ostentatious wealth is spiritual poverty, so they're flattered by ads that presume their love of simplicity. Amidst all this phoniness, there's one idea that actually rings true: the notion of man and machine unity. To illustrate that feeling, car advertising commonly uses images of sex or power. But even more alluring to the safe sex generation is the promise of Satori, or spiritual enlightenment. It may seem brave to flaunt such a Japanese style while politicians and the media are still bashing that country over its economic superiority. But these ads allude to a safer, ancient Japan, to the humble little country where people spend all day raking rocks. And anyway, the campaign really wants to give us spiritual permission to accept the not particularly Japanese idea, but the very upwardly mobile idea of luxury. Maybe the best antidote to these ads would be to have that pink mechanical bunny that Energizer Batteries is using march across the screen and kick the narrator in the shinto.
Leslie Savin writes about advertising for The Village Voice. Naomi Person produces our commentaries and music reviews. Amy Salad and Phyllis Myers produce our interviews. Our production assistants are Joan Tui and Roberta Shorrock. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet baritone saxophonist, arranger, and composer Jerry Mulligan. His work with Gil Evans, Miles Davis, and Chet Baker launched what became known as cool jazz. Also, jazz critic Evan Whitehead reviews a new collection of Fats Waller recordings. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.